FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. It's May 31st, 2018, the last day of May. Well, how was your May? Mine was great. Did some traveling and saw some people, got some projects on the fire. It looks like summer is going to be amazing. In any event, to make my day amazing, send me an email. My best part of the day is when I wake up in the morning and check out all the emails in my inbox from you out there, you loyal FSN community members. So the email address, as a reminder, kl@kerrylutz.com. Markets are in interesting position right now. They're pretty much sideways in so many markets, with the exception of the U.S. dollar. Housing is just burning things up, but there is no real indicator because it's so many separate sub-markets across the country. There's 400 sub-markets, but overall housing has definitely remained strong in light of the 10-year going over 3%. And interest rates generally headed higher. And I see here in Florida, in my little neck of the woods, every major city in the Sunshine State, some call it Florida, is just in hyperdrive. I mean, a brand new project in Northern Palm Beach County, 1,500 units. They're about two-thirds of the way through or three-quarters of the way through. They've sold every single unit at full asking price, and then some. They even raised their prices. Can the good times go on? Will it continue? Well, our good friend Dave Kranzler, Dave, you run investmentresearchdynamics.com with us now. Dave, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Kerry. It's been a while. I look forward to catching up.
Yeah, absolutely. So we got these markets, they're heading sideways, but the actual Main Street markets seem to be doing a lot better. Job numbers, well, workforce participation rate hasn't really gone up much. It very well might not go up much, but the rigged unemployment numbers are great. And, you know, I think that there really is a tightening of the labor market. I think a lot of people went early retirement, Dave. They went Social Security. They went disability. And I said, I don't care how good the economy is, I'm not going back to work. What is your take on all this?
Well, I mean, if you apply the law of economics to that argument, how come wages aren't going through the roof? If you've got a shortage of something, the price rises, and that's how you solve the shortage. So even if the explanation is that people took early retirement, and I don't buy that, if you raise wages enough, some of those people are going to come out and start working again. Now, I've actually done a fair amount of research into this, and I've talked to a fair amount of people. And to be sure, there's certain skilled labor or skilled technology positions where there's select shortages. But you're not the idea that there's a general labor shortage isn't being confirmed by the price of labor, which is your wage rate. In fact, wages aren't even keeping up with the real rate of inflation.
Yeah, that's,
so yeah. I think it's another Orwellian propaganda narrative that they're throwing out there, because, you know, if you look under the hood on the employment report, as you referenced, you see there's a 38% of the working age population isn't even counted as part of the labor force. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But I think a lot of it also has to do with they can't find a job that suits what they want to do and suits their income taste. So they apply for a student loan, mm-hmm. and they go to University of Phoenix online university, and they're not counted as part of the labor force.
Well, maybe they'll be able to qualify for a job at Google or an internship. I hear that Google likes to hire from the University of Phoenix online, at least they did in the movie. So with Vince Vaughn and Orn Wilson, it was quite funny. But yeah, you know, you're right. The student loan debt is skyrocketing, going to hit $1.5 trillion. And that is not the sign of a healthy economy. Escalating debt at all levels, at every level of the economy, from private to personal to auto to just retail debt, you name it, it just keeps going up. So not a healthy sign. But one thing is, like in Florida here, the biggest, the probably biggest job shortage in construction is the guy to go around with a broom after you're done with your job and clean the stuff up. They just can't seem to find enough of those people around here.
Well, you know, again, you mean because there's always a mess everywhere.
There's a mess.
You know,
mess.
Again, if that were the case, all they got to do is raise the amount of wage they're willing to pay for someone to do that job, and you're going to solve the inability to find someone to actually do it. You just got to pay them more.
And I think, though, that people being very insecure about the economy, companies, they just say, you know what? We'll just lay them on more overtime. We're not going to raise wages. We're not going to hire, because look, what hiring has become like in the American economy is like just a blank check. You take on a potential litigant, you know, that you're going to pay to sue you, and all of these things, workman's comp and unemployment insurance and everything else that you pay when you hire employees, the incentive is there not to do it. It really is.
That's right. And just sort of to kind of extend that thought about, you know, not hiring and paying overtime. I mean, the major auto manufacturers, Ford and General Motors, General Motors is now hiring a lot more part-time people and getting rid of full-time people because that reduces their costs, right? Then they avoid paying healthcare. And Ford is essentially shutting down its sedan production business. It's just going to focus on trucks. I think it's keeping a couple of sedan models alive. But, I mean, there you're talking about thousands of well-trained factory employees who are going to hit the job market.
Hey, yeah, Ford is, I should have mentioned this in other shows. If I didn't, I neglected, because I do follow the auto industry. But Ford is getting rid of the Taurus. They're getting rid of the Fusion. They're keeping like that little sedan that they have, that little economy car, Econo Box, and the Mustang. Outside of that, they're strictly going to be focused on SUVs and personal trucks. So I guess they'll come out with more models of them. But yeah, the auto industry changed significantly, and that is a major indicator of it. So companies hiring more part-time workers, even though Trump was elected and ran on a platform of jobs, 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 that aspect really hasn't changed, has it?
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, you know, we've had the deindustrialization of this country has been going on since the mid-1990s. And the jobs that were available that people were paid a lot of money for, most of those disappeared.
Yes.
And some people have been able to transition into the service sector. There's an interesting thing, you know, I wanted to point out, getting back to the tightness of labor idea. And that is, if you look at Social Security disability, starting in 2008, and I'm not tying this specifically politically to Obama or Democrats, but the amount of people and the ability to qualify for Social Security disability soared starting in 2008. The number of people who were receiving it soared. And, you know, if you got a job and it's not paying enough to make ends meet, if you can qualify for SSDI, why wouldn't you just quit that job and take the SSDI? And again, that removes you from the labor force. So,
exactly.
You know, two of the government subsidized techniques that they've been able to use to camouflage the true rate of unemployment is Social Security disability and student loans. And student loans have also skyrocketed over the last 10 years, and they're both going to become very problematic.
Oh, I totally agree with you on that. Yeah. And there's no way those student loans are getting paid back. You can't discharge them in bankruptcy. It's a horrible, horrible situation for a young adult to be in. I mean, where's the hope in your life? It's just terrible what the government has done. And this is all because of bad economic policy that encourages bad behavior or encourages wrong choices, right?
Right. Also known as moral hazard.
Yeah, the Dukes of Moral Hazard. Right? So, you know, that's what we have there, though. I mean, really. And these factors. So look at the stock market and tell me why I shouldn't be investing my last dollar that I have into Amazon.
I'm a well-known Amazon bear out there, and I dissect their numbers every quarter. I've dissected their numbers going back to 2004. I dig into corners of the footnotes that Wall Street analysts just don't dare to go, because it's frightening when you actually really dig under the hood and take apart the engine parts of Amazon. So, you know, the truth about Amazon is that it bleeds a couple billion, well, more than a couple billion of cash flow every year. And they use their accounting gimmicks to put on a pretty presentation that shows that they're generating free cash flow on a trailing 12-month basis. Interestingly, that free cash flow has been the way they calculate it. And they admit they were forced to admit by the SEC in their financial filings that the way they calculate free cash flow is not considered generally acceptable accounting principles or based on GAAP. So, Amazon is really, if you just watch how Bezos, what happens when he goes into a new business area, he slashes the prices, and the stock is keyed off sales growth. And that's all the market cares about is sales growth. They don't really dig into the numbers the way I dig into them. So, for instance, there's no reason for them to have their international e-commerce business. The international e-commerce business on a trailing 12-month basis lost close to $1 billion of, you know, an operating loss. I'm not talking about net income or cash flow, operating loss of close to $1 billion. But it generates, I forget what the percentage of sales are of the overall sales. I want to say something like 20-25%.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but in all honesty, from a shareholder standpoint, you know, other than if you want to keep watching the stock, you know, go, you know, blow up into a parabolic bubble, from a shareholder standpoint, in terms of generating economics that benefit shareholders, besides, you know, what happens to the share price in a huge bubble, you would want them to shut down their international e-commerce business.
Yeah, well, the things that's the most profitable in Amazon's a business most people don't even know they're in. They're S3 servers, I think they are.
It's their cloud service business. Yeah,
that's the most profitable division of the company. And I find that really humorous, because the average stock analyst knows absolutely nothing about that business. It's economics, it's hazards. I mean, they are probably the best cloud source business out there. But still, does that really justify a valuation of the company like we're talking about? Hey, so what, in a lot of ways, you know, Amazon is a lot like Tesla, isn't it?
I'm glad you said that, because I've been saying that for a while. And to me, they're both representative of what a massive Ponzi scheme bubble the entire stock market is.
Yeah, well, so if those are the high flyers, at least Apple actually has sales and they have profits and they have products. But if those are the high flyers that are leading this whole thing, they can only be leading us to oblivion, right?
Well, I think so. I mean, as it turns out, year to date for 2018, there's four stocks that have been driving any kind of returns on the S&P, and one of them is Amazon.
Yeah.
Amazon, Apple, Netflix, and Microsoft. Those four stocks are responsible for a very large percentage of the S&P's performance this year.
Yeah, and Netflix has become the most valuable media company in the world. Honestly, I just canceled my subscription to them because they raised the price to $12 a month. And, you know, granted, if I had just simply pulled the plug, cut the cable, you know, and gone to all these little services to try to make up for what I got rid of from cable, it probably wouldn't save me any money. I know people are doing this, but I don't quite understand the whole cable cutting concept here. I don't see what benefit you get from it other than to brag to your friends that you've been able to cut the cable.
I agree with that. I mean, I do the math in my head. I actually use a Roku stick, which is way better than the Amazon Fire Stick, because
yes,
my fiance at her house has a Fire Stick, and the Roku is, it's just easier to use and it's faster. And I mm-hmm. can kind of see how you could probably piece together everything that you like to watch and get rid of the rest. But I don't think you really save any money versus, you know, subscribing to DirecTV or to broadband cable.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense to me. I've looked at it. I've studied it. It's like, why do I want to pay 8 bills instead of 1 that come out to almost the same thing? And then I can't get rid of the cable company because I still need to have their internet service. How is that helpful, David? I'm missing something from this. I have friends that have done it. My kids, well, one of them has done it, and actually he never had cable, so he didn't really care. But I'm a media-centric person. We're in this business, and I just don't see how we escape the cable company. I mean, yeah, it can be done. That's wonderful, but what you get out of it, I'm not really sure. Hey, let's switch gears, look at precious metals. So we got gold. I haven't looked at it in the last half hour or two. Let's pop up Kitco on the phone. It's the easiest place to find gold prices. Hey, we're over 1,300 again in gold. Silver's up 14 cents, mid-16s. But it's basically been for years like watching paint dry.
Yes. Well, I wouldn't say for years. I mean, if you, I like to try and advise people to look at gold as a long-term investment. It's not like your typical Wall Street pump and dump situation where, you know, you're only worried, you know, what are the algos going to do for me tomorrow? And yeah. if you look at the rate of return on gold going back to when it bottomed in mid-December 2015, I mean, gold's in a really, really nice uptrend. I mean, so here, I'll just let me just run a quick number here. So since it bottomed in mid-December 2015, it's up 22.5% over that time period.
Mm-hmm.
Not a bad rate of return. I mean, I know Amazon investors want 20% a week, but
yeah.
22.5% over what is essentially a 2.5-year time period is not a bad rate of return considering, you know, the risk profile for gold. Now, gold had a massive run up. I mean, it was up well over 30% very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And then it corrected. And it's been in a really nice bullish uptrend ever since it bottomed. I mean, you can pull up a chart and you see. And I think that probably surprises a lot of people, because there's such a conflict out there between the gold bulls and the people who are kind of anti-gold. So, you know, again, if you just look at a daily chart of gold, it bounced right where you would think it would bounce at its uptrend line, and it's curling higher. It's getting ready to go back over the 200-day moving average. The technical, you know, just the sort of the generic technical indicators, the MACD and the RSI are set up in, you know, are positioned for, you know, where you'd say, hey, this looks pretty bullish. So, and one of my tests on that is the behavior of the mining stocks.
Yeah.
And
great point you're raising.
Notwithstanding the fact that if you value just any mining stock index relative to the price of gold, so as a product of the price of gold, the only two times mining stocks have been cheaper right now relative to the price of gold since I've been doing this sector going back to 2001 was in 2001 and in December 2015. So if you, I'm just looking at a chart of the GDX here. I mean, it had a huge run after the sector bottomed, Mm-hmm. And then it had a big sell-off. I mean, it's, you know, mining stocks are volatile. People need to understand that when they invest in them. You know, they're, again, it's not, you know, you don't have hedge fund algos driving it higher every day the way you do Tesla and Amazon. So they tend to have a lot of volatility. But if you look at GDX, I mean, it's kind of coiling in sort of a classic bull coil where, you know, the Bollinger Bands are tightening up. It to me, it looks like, you know, unless for some reason the price of gold and silver get hit really hard, these mining stocks are ready to launch again.
Yeah, and the cycles are looking good. The four or five cycle guys that I follow, and you know who they are, guys like even Martin Armstrong is bullish on gold. He hasn't been bullish on gold since 2011 or so. Since he got out of prison, you know, and I interviewed him, like I was one of the first people to interview him right after he got out. And I want to get into like miscarriages of justice, but he's definitely a victim there for sure. They wanted his algorithms and he didn't want to give them. That's his story. He's sticking to it. But in any event, Armstrong's bullish, Nenner's bullish. I don't know if you know Nick Santiago or not. He's a great guy.
I've seen his stuff occasionally. Yeah,
in the moneystocks.com, not that I'm advertising him. He's bullish. And Eric Haddock, 6-8 other people are all bullish for the end of the year. But the end of the year could come early this year. It could come like right around the middle of the summer or the middle of the third quarter. I'm kind of on your side there for this. I've never been one to say, oh, it's going to the moon. The only time I thought it was going to go up forever was during 2011 when it go up $100 in a day. But we all know what happened there. It's the same exact mania that happened for Bitcoin, not to gently nudge into cryptocurrencies. You got any particular take on them?
On the cryptos?
Yeah.
I'm just watching them from the distance. I'm skeptical. I mean, I've tried to analyze them every way I can. And the argument that there's no counterparty risk doesn't hold water. I mean, just being a product of the internet means you inherently have counterparty risk because you're at the mercy of the government that lets the internet operate in their boundaries.
There's a lot of those types of issues that haven't been addressed, but right now it's trading at 7,300. We look at it, it was up to 19,400. So it's down $12,000 a Bitcoin. That's like 70% without doing the math. It's a perfect Fibonacci retracement. And, you know, for something that is immune from all market disciplines or pressures, right? It seems to be behaving exactly like a mania that busted out. That's my take on it. Yeah, 63% it's down, and it's been down as much as 80%+. It could go down as much as 90% from there. My feeling is I'm pretty bullish about the future of cryptos, only because it's becoming rational. Right now, the market's not rational, and you see these anomalies take place all over in everyone out there. So in the future, good place to be. At the present time, you still got to wait before you're going to make any money off of them. Just my personal view, and I called the crash. By the way, I wrote an article in December 17th saying this stuff was going to crash and as much as 80%. And that's one of my few major market calls that I've really gone out on the line to make. But you know, there it is. It happened. So not because I'm a genius, just because I'm a student of bubbles.
Sure. And all you needed to do was watch what the real players were doing. The founder of Bitcoin sold all of his when it was around 16,000 or 17,000. And same with the founder of Litecoin. He completely sold out right before the stuff crashed. I mean, yeah. If these guys aren't holding on to what they've created, why should I?
Yeah, totally correct. Hey, so let's one more topic, then we'll take off. Real estate. I know that's something you follow extremely closely, and it seems like that is a market that's flashing danger, Will Robinson. We're peaking. We're at prices. Prices are in many markets, not all, but in many, are over their 2006, 2007 peaks, well over, and the money's pouring into it. The lending is not quite as irresponsible as it was. The underwriting has tightened up. So it's not as bad as it was. A lot of cash buyers out there, especially in Florida. But it seems like we're getting to the end of the cycle, doesn't it?
Well, what's interesting is there's a lot of mainstream media noise made about the strength of the housing market. And what they point to is the price inflation. They're calling it, you know, the price appreciation. It's really price inflation. It's not being confirmed by volume. So if you know you like technical analysis, the price action is not being confirmed by volume. The volume on home sales is still, you know, for existing home sales, it's running, I want to say, about 70 or 80% of the peak back in 2005. And new home sales are running, I don't know, I haven't run the numbers for a while, but just call it for sake of argument, about 60% of peak volume. So you've got price inflation has gone back to the level where it was at the previous peak. In some couple select markets, it's gone above the previous peak. It's not being supported by underlying volume. And now what you've been seeing with the last several existing and new home sales reports, and again, notwithstanding the statistical chicanery that goes on, one thing that always has blown my mind is both the National Association of Realtors and the Census Bureau report their home sales metric as a seasonally adjusted annualized rate.
Right.
And when I see seasonally adjusted, the first thing that comes to my mind is statistical sausage grinder. but then they take that and annualize it. Now, why are you reporting an annualized rate for a number that's collected monthly and reported monthly? Why are they reporting an annualized rate? Just show us what you think the monthly number is. You know,
and even it's a survey.
Do your statistical hocus pocus and just tell us what you think the monthly number is. Now, for the last, I want to say probably since November, December, and again, the numbers, especially the Census Bureau reports, there's a lot of volatility in the numbers because I just think it has to do with the way their statistical sausage grinder operates. Mm-hmm. But the volume of sales has been in a downtrend. And we saw this with the latest new and existing home sales reports last week, where both came in well below what Wall Street was looking for. And regardless of what they want to say is the SAR, the seasonally adjusted annualized rate numbers, I like to look for other Main Street data points that might, you know, tell me what's real and what's not. So if the Mortgage Bankers Association publishes its mortgage application report, and it breaks down into refinance applications, which have been completely cratering, and purchase applications. Now, for the last 5 weeks, purchase applications have been down 2% week to week, every week, except the first week in May. It was down 0.2%. Mm-hmm. And the last time it was unchanged from the previous week was for April 20th. So you've had, in what should be the heart of the home buying season, you've had 5 weeks in a row of a decline in purchase contracts. So again, this is the type of information that's not going to get reported in the mainstream media. All they're going to report is what's happening with housing prices. Well, a couple months ago, in my Short Sellers Journal, which is a weekly subscription, I published a chart that showed the creation of mortgage debt and home prices. And you can go and get the information on the St. Louis Fred website. And I just created a chart using their data. And there's almost a one-to-one correlation between the increasing rate of mortgage debt and the rate of home price increases. So, and for the last 3 years, every year, the government has lowered the bar in terms of what it takes to qualify for a conforming mortgage. So, you know, they went from a 5% down payment Fannie and Freddie mortgage to a 3% down payment. And they also cut the mortgage insurance that people who use less than a 20% down payment have to pay. And then the next year, they lowered the income requirements and they raised the debt to income ratio to 45%. And then this past year, they raised the debt to income ratio again to 50%. Now, what that means is that if you take down a mortgage, you go out and you buy a house, $500,000 house, you put 0 to 3% down, the money doesn't even have to come from your pocket.
Yeah.
And including the new mortgage that you're using to buy the house, the government says it's okay if you spend 50% of your pre-tax income on debt service on a monthly basis.
That's crazy.
So tell me how that's not subprime.
Yeah. Hey, and if you do other things like under FHA, you're allowed to have the seller pay the closing costs. So you,
yes,
it's not like you can really walk away with money. But you certainly can walk away not paying anything for that house, because in Florida, your closing costs could be 2 to 3% of your purchase price.
Oh, it's higher than that, I bet.
It depends. There's factors involved without getting into it. But yeah, you can basically buy that house. And if you just happen to be a realtor and you're going to get your commission paid back to you, you wind up walking away with cash in your pocket from a sale, which is not a good thing to have, because it means that bad behavior that we had before is going to be repeated anyway. So really cause for concern, although I will tell you, in Florida, the market is red hot. Anecdotally speaking, the skyline of Florida City looks like skyline of cities in China, with just construction boom after construction crane as far as the eye can see. It's remarkable, Dave. But even Florida will run out of gas. What Florida has going for it, as do other states like Tennessee and states with no income tax, is high tax people are fleeing from New York, California, Illinois, and all of those great places to the low tax states, especially after the latest tax increase. The tax bill, which increased the cost, the after-tax cost of home ownership, not just in the blue states, but in the red states as well, for higher income earners. So we got some interesting times ahead. Let's see if this time really is different. Dave, just tell us where to find you.
My website's investmentresearchdynamics.com, and I try to post original content, you know, 4 to 5 times a week. And then on that website, there's links to my mining stock journal, which is a twice a month, primarily junior mining stock subscription newsletter. And then my short sellers journal, which I publish on a weekly basis.
Cool. Hey, we'll have a link to it in the show notes to this interview. And take a look at financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Sign up for our free newsletter. Email me, kl@kerrylutz.com. And if you want to subscribe to the show automatically, if you're on YouTube, click the subscribe button and click that little bell, and you'll automatically get notified when new episodes are posted. Otherwise, subscribe on iTunes. Just go to the iTunes store, search Kerry Lutz or Financial Survival Network, and then you click subscribe like 8 times, and eventually the show will be automatically delivered to your computer or your phone, whatever. Dave, it's great reconnecting with you. We'll talk to you again real soon. Be well, my friend.
Thanks, Kerry. You too.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.